The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Each month this year, intrepid members of the Guardian Books team have trekked to the top of the Queen Elizabeth's Hall on London's South Bank to visit a writer coming to the end of 4 days interned on a boat, modelled on the one in Joseph Conrad's novella, The Heart of Darkness. I'm in the lift going up now. We've braved wind and rain and the occasional burst of sunshine to meet up with Jeanette Winterson, Michael Ondaatje, and Carol Phillips, among others. And as September settles in, we're back to talk to Teju Cole, writer, art historian, and street photographer. And here we are. Teju was born in the United States to Nigerian parents, grew up in Nigeria, and now lives in New York. His two books, a novella, Every Day is for the Thief, and a novel, Open City, have signalled the arrival of an exceptional new talent, bringing to mind for a Guardian reviewer Christopher Isherwood's famous image of himself as a camera with its shutter open, quite passive, recording. Who better then to take up Art Angel's challenge of writing an essay musing on rivers, Joseph Conrad, London, any or all of these things from a vantage point high above the streets of the Olympic City.
Yeah, this is my third day here, and I think what's most interesting about it is that I feel as if I've seen the four seasons already. You know, we've had squalls and we've got, you know, some cold weather and very hot weather. And
you're a photographer as well as a writer. Which part of you has been most in operation as you sit up here observing things and thinking?
Well, I've had to write a piece about being here, so I've been very much in word mode. I thought I would be able to take really interesting photographs here, but I've frankly been so overwhelmed by the view that I'm sort of reduced to taking boring tourist shots. So I think my photographs from up here would be just as uninteresting as anyone else's. I think I need something less spectacular in order to take good photos.
Let's just walk towards the boat along the gangplank and tell us what you can see from right up here on the top of the South Bank.
Well, what I see is an active city, a modern metropolis. That is what the polite side of myself sees. And then if I go one layer below that, what I see is evidence of many, many decades, perhaps centuries of plunder, the world's wealth. This is the world city, you know. This was the empire that ruled most of the world. And the physical form of London itself shows that wealth. It is a great city in part because the whole world has contributed to it, not always willingly. Now, that being said, it's a beautiful vista. It's spectacular, and it's good that many people all around the world can come here now and enjoy some part of it.
And there's a helicopter you can hear buzzing in, and that's some sort of surveillance helicopter, which is a slightly sinister addition to this very carnivalesque atmosphere.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, it's part of the sort of reality of modern life in a city like London, or also in New York, you know, security states, surveillance states. You have embassies and you have houses of parliament and you have Ferris wheels and people enjoying amusement park entertainments. So I think this is true of any historical moment, but at this particular moment, I feel as if we're living in a time of just great ontological confusion where free societies about liberty and about individual opportunity, but at the same time there's a great deal of plunder still going on. There are foreign wars being conducted on our behalfs. There are security apparatus everywhere you look, and then you also have like a mass populace that's only interested in entertainment and taking their mind off things. So it's not an innocent vista. you know, I tend to look on the dark side.
Tell us a bit about the dark side you've been thinking about in your essay.
Well, being invited to stay in this boat was very exciting and very interesting. It was also extremely awkward because I have very strong post-colonial and anti-colonial views, and this boat is a sort of homage to Joseph Conrad. But that turned out not to be the case because I wanted to take it in a slightly different direction. And I started to think about what writerly calling was about. What kind of activity are we taking part in when we write about others? Which is what Heart of Darkness is. And I sort of trace that primarily through the figure of V.S. Naipaul, who is maybe our major living exemplar of going to write about the so-called dark places of the earth. Even though we do know that, as it says in Heart of Darkness, London is one of the dark places of the earth. Oh, actually, what it says is that London was one of the dark places of the earth, but I think it is one of the dark places of the earth. So I just wanted to examine this idea of writing about others, and I did that through a narrative about an encounter with V.S. Naipaul.
So let's now hear your essay. Thank you very much.
2 years ago, I was invited to a dinner party in New York. It took place on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, in a penthouse apartment. Our host was not merely rich, she had a name that through long association with money had itself become a shorthand for wealth. The dinner was being held in honor of a writer, by now old and famous, on the publication of his latest and perhaps final book. And because the book was about Africa, and because as a man ages, his thoughts circle around questions of legacy, the writer, who was not himself African, had requested, in lieu of a normal book launch, a quiet dinner with a group of young African writers. This was how I came to be invited. I stood in the luxurious living room of the penthouse, glass in hand, surrounded by Morandi's paintings and Picasso's prints. To the sound of a small bell from a private elevator, the old writer and his middle-aged wife emerged. He was short and stout, a little fat even, though you could see that he hadn't always been so, and he walked across the marble floor unsteadily, with the aid of a walking stick and with the aid of his wife, a dark-haired, dark-eyed woman, taller than him, glamorous in her pashmina. My agent, who was also the old writer's agent, introduced us. "Teju, meet Vidya Naipaul." The faint hiss of champagne being poured, the clink of glasses. Far below us was the muttering obscurity of the East River, and beyond it the Borough of Queens, glimmering in the dark. In all that darkness was an infinity of information, invisible under the cloak of night. "Vidya, please call me Vidya," he had said, whom the agent had told about my work on Lagos and New York, said, "Have you written about Tutuola?" I said, "No, I hadn't." "It would be interesting," he said. I demurred and said I found the work odd, minor. There was something in Tutuola's ghosts and forests and an idiomatic English that confirmed the prejudices of a European audience. "That's what would be interesting about it," he said. "A reconsideration. You would be able to say something about it, something of value." "As a marvelous view from the roof," our host said. "Vidya is afraid of heights. He gets vertigo," said Nadira, Lady Naipaul. And when the women had moved away, because I was nervous, because I wanted to show off a little for the master, I said, "Maybe we don't all need the thrill of physical heights. Frank O'Connor writes somewhere that reading is another form of height, and a more perilous one." "Oh," Vidya said, "that's very good." And we were called in to dinner. I write these words in London. August has ended. I am sitting on the enclosed upper deck of a kind of boat. The boat is an architectural folly that has been placed on top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall. Up there, on the roof of the hall, it is as though it has been stranded after a flood. The sky is crisp and white, the sky which has returned to page one as it does each morning. Below, the busy little people begin to go about their day, inscrutable to the one who watches, unknown to themselves. London, from this peculiar vantage point, is precise as a print. Toy red buses cross and recross Waterloo Bridge as though maddened into repetition.
St. Paul's Cathedral leads white. The buildings across the skyline follow, white on white. The stone of London is white and pale. The sky is white and pale and beginning to intimate blue. Laden barges bring the news of the world in the form of goods. Above all this, I sit on a boat stranded in Thames River. At dinner, in addition to Sir Vidya and Lady Naipaul, there was a well-known American actor and his third wife. There was Vidya's editor, our agent and his wife, our host, and three other young African writers. The host's family claret was served with dinner, served after a proud announcement of its provenance, and poured almost ritualistically. Such things are bound to disappoint, but this one was possibly the best wine I had ever tasted. And buoyed by it, we began to toast V.S. Naipaul, who sat in his chair, bunched up in it, serene but a little tired, nodding repeatedly, saying, thank you, with his characteristic bis, the repetition of language that was second nature to him. When three or four others had spoken, I gathered up my courage and said, Vidya, I would like to join the others in celebrating your work. Though, in truth, the new book, called The Mask of Africa, ostensibly a study of African religion, was poor, not as good as his other voyages of inquiry, oddly narrow and stilted, though still full of beautiful observation and language. But there is a time for literary criticism and a time for toasts. I went on. Your work has meant so much to an entire generation of post-colonial writers. I don't agree with all your views, and in fact there are many of them I strongly disagree with. I said strongly, with what I hoped was a menacing tone. But from you, I have learned how to be productively disagreeable in my own views. I and others have learned from you that it is fine to be independent, that it is fine to go your own way and go against the crowd. You went your own way, no matter what it cost you. Thank you for that. I raised my glass, and everyone else raised theirs. A silence fell, and Vidya looked sober, almost chastened, but it was a soft look. Thank you, he said. I'm very moved. I'm very moved. This boat, of which I am temporary captain, is named the Roi des Belges. In 1890, Joseph Conrad piloted a steamship down the Congo on a boat with the same name. That journey became his inspiration for Heart of Darkness, a puzzling novella with nested narrators which unfolded a shadowed, strangled, brutal tale that he wrote in the last year of the 19th century and published at the beginning of the 20th. So, this perch on which I sit above the Thames, the sky is blue now, the 180-degree view of it full of long stratus clouds, this perch in which the city is exposed to me, but I am not to it, is an homage to Conrad's bitter vision. What might it mean when the native pilots the ship? What happens when the natives on the shore, numerous, unindividuated, are white? Heart of Darkness was written when rapacious extraction of African resources by European adventure was gospel truth, as it still is. The book helped create the questions that occupy us till this day. What does it mean when we write about others? Who are these others? More pressingly, who are the articulate we? In the Heart of Darkness, the natives, the niggers as they are called in the book, the word falling each time like a lance, speak only twice, once to express enthusiasm for cannibalism, then later on to bring the inarticulate report, Mr. Kurtz, he dead. Otherwise, these niggers, these savages, are little more than shadows and violence, either in dumb service on the boat, or in dumb, grieved, uncomprehending and deadly attacks on it from the shore. Not only is this primitive, subhuman Africa incoherent to any African, it is incoherent to any right-thinking non-African too. 100 years ago, it was taken as a commonplace truth. It wasn't outside the mainstream of European opinions about Africans. But we have all moved on. Those things are in the past, are they not? For the first 4 days, it rained. Vidya's face crinkled with pleasure. You like that? I do, very much. It's simple, it's promising. I like it too, he said. What I had just quoted was the first line of The Enigma of Arrival, his intricate novel about life in rural England. I value Naipaul for his travel narratives, for his visits to the so-called dark places of the earth, the patient way he teases out complicated non-fictional stories from his various interlocutors in Iran, Indonesia, India, and elsewhere. I like A Million Mutinies Now, Among the Believers, and The Crocodiles of Yamoussoukro, which, uncomfortable as they are in parts, also have the force of revelation. They are courageous not because they voice unpopular and sometimes wrong-headed opinions, but for the opposite reason. The books contain little opinion and are, rather, artful compressions of dozens of conversations. These are texts in which the natives, whomever they might be, speak for themselves. The contradistinction to Conrad is glaring, and give an account, sometimes inadvertently, of the contradictions of their beliefs, their ways of life, but also of their deep humanity. But it was the enigma of arrival, tirelessly intense, its intelligence fastened to the world of humans and of nature, that most influenced my own work, my own ear. I adore, still, its language, its inner music. In no small part, Vidya's writing held my interest because he too, after all, was one of the natives. He too was thought savage and, in his cruel term, half-made. He was a contradiction like no other. Dinner was over. We were in conversation, Vidya, our host, and me. He was in a good mood, flattered by the attention. Our host brought some rare books from her collection to show us. They were special editions of Mark Twain's works, and on the fly leaf of each was an epigram written by Twain in his own hand, and below, his signature. The epigrams were typical Twain, ironic, dark. And so we leaned over the old volumes, and Vidya and I squinted and tried to make out the words from Twain's elegant but occasionally illegible hand. We were sitting side by side, and Vidya, unsteady, had placed a hand on my knee for support, unselfconsciously. I read, "By trying, we can easily learn to endure adversity. Another man's, I mean." Laughter. Another was, "To succeed in other trades, capacity must be shown. In the law, concealment of it will do." More laughter. Vidya began, "You know, these remind me very much of," ever the eager student, I blurted out, "La Rochefoucauld." "Yes," he said, "yes, La Rochefoucauld." And with wonder in his eyes, the weight from his hand and arm bearing down on me, he turned his head up to our host, who stood just behind, and said, "He's very good. He speaks so well. He speaks well." And turning back to me, "You speak very well." In any other context, it would have felt like faint praise. But we'd drunk claret. We were laughing along to long-dead Twain, and I had managed to surprise the wily old master. Our host drifted away, and Vidya and I continued chatting about this and that. Swift judgments came down. Hemingway was bogus. The simplicity was nothing, Vidya said, like his. Things Fall Apart was a fine book, but Achebe's refusal to write about his decades in America was disappointing. Heart of Darkness was good, but structurally a failure. I asked him about the biography by Patrick French, The World is What It Is, which he had authorized. He stiffened. That book, which was extraordinarily well written, was also shocking in the extent to which it revealed a nasty, petty, and insecure man. "One gives away so much in trust," Vidya said. "One expects a certain discretion. It's painful, it's painful. But that's quite all right. Others will be written. The record will be corrected." He sounded like a boy being brave after gashing his thumb. The party was ending. I said, "This was not what I expected." "Oh," he said, some new mischief in his eyes. "And what did you expect?" "I don't know, not this. I thought you'd be surly and that I'd be rude." He was pleased. "Very good, very good. So you must write about this. You must write it down so others know. That would be good for you too." The combination of ego, tenderness, and sly provocation was typical. Finally, after about 20 minutes, Nadira came for her husband. The hand lifted itself from its resting place on my knee. This benevolent old roomy-eyed soul, so fond of the word nigger, so aggressive in his lack of sympathy towards Africa, so brutal in his treatment of women. He knew nothing about that. He knew only that he needed help standing up, needed help walking across the grand marble-floored foyer towards the private elevator. The city below. The city at night, the city during the day. At certain heights, you get vertigo, but you also see what you otherwise might not.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.